Ever wonder if there's more to the movies you love? Do you like to ponder how they got from A to Z? Who chose the plot twists? Why use those characters? Is there a deeper meaning? We're here to explore those questions and maybe learn a bit along the way. VGB Studios proudly presents The Filmlosophers.
Hello and welcome to another exciting episode of The Filmlosophers, the show that gets into the movies you love and digs a little deeper. I am your host, Eddie Villanueva, and alongside me, as always, is Mr. Spencer, hook in the hand, love in the other, Williams.
I don't want to ask questions about that.
Oh, we got a great show in store as we're going to be talking about the classic horror film that is soon to be getting a facelift, if you will, and that is 1992's Candyman. So stick around as we dive into that. We're going to be getting into the subtle nuances of the movie, but also talking about kind of who was the real bad guy in this movie, huh?
Almost not really a question.
Spoiler alert, Spencer's got opinions, so. Uh-huh. But before we dive into those opinions, Spencer, why don't you give him that opening credits?
Tune in each and every Wednesday morning on all your favorite streaming platforms and over on our website at filmlosophers.com. Also connect with us on the socials at facebook.com/filmlosophers and on Twitter and Instagram at filmlosophy101.
That's right. You can check us out on all the streaming platforms. Everywhere you stream podcasts, we are there. So check us out on Apple Play or iTunes, Google Play, Libsyn, Player FM, Audio Boom, Spotify, Pandora. Anywhere where you listen to podcasts, we are there. Drop us a line. Let us know you're listening. Give us a 5-star review. We love hearing from the folks. Also, check us out on the website. We got over 280 episodes on that website. That's incredible. We've got like 5 years of just content just waiting for you to peruse. Go check it out. Filmlosophers.com. Also, we're on socials. We try to be as much as we can. We're more so on Facebook and on Twitter, so you could find us there. Spencer's usually just twiddling his thumbs.
Yeah.
He doesn't do social media.
I do not.
He will be, though. Don't worry. We're going to get him on socials. We're going to get him on the socials. But speaking of getting Spencer to do things, we are going to talk about the film that I had mentioned previous, the movie that is getting the facelift, the unique one and only Candyman. Now, as I mentioned earlier, this movie is getting a little bit of a facelift as they're doing a remake by Naya DaCosta, and we are going to be reviewing that movie next week. However, in the interim, we wanted to revisit the classic film that started it all and get a chance to get our thoughts on it and to see where that whole trajectory is going. So before we continue, Spencer, give them that official synopsis goodness.
Skeptical graduate student Helen Lyle befriends Anne Marie McCoy while researching superstitions in a housing project on Chicago's near North Side. From Anne Marie, Helen learns about the Candyman, a knife-wielding figure of urban legend that some of her neighbors believe to be responsible for a recent murder. After a mysterious man matching the Candyman's descriptions begins stalking her, Helen comes to fear the legend may be all too real.
Written and directed by Bernard Rose, the film stars Virginia Madsen, Tony Todd, Xander Berkeley, Casey Lemons, and Vanessa E. Williams. If you're not aware, or maybe if you're like, wait a second, I thought this was, you know, a Clive Barker movie. Oh my gosh, what's going on? No, Clive Barker actually wrote the short story called The Forbidden that this movie is based on. So Bernard Rose took that inspiration and created what we now have as the original film. Clive Barker has a hand in it. He was a part of the screenwriting, but ultimately Bernard Rose wrote the actual script that is now in the film. So like we mentioned, this is a movie that dates back to 1992. So we're looking at almost 30 years ago. And this is a movie that, like most other horror films, Spencer has yet to have seen prior.
Yep.
So one of the things about this movie, especially when it comes to movies that have a unique tie, like had you had ever heard about this movie prior to this?
Yeah, I had heard of it. I knew Tony Todd's face was connected to this movie somehow.
Okay.
I don't know.
Okay, where do you know Tony Todd from outside of Candyman?
I don't. Like, I just know, like, the space and Candyman, and that's kind of it.
Really?
Yeah. Like, okay. He could have popped his head into something.
Did you ever see Final Destination?
Yeah, a long time ago though.
He's the mortuary guy. He's like he's one who's like, oh, death has a plan for all of you, and blah, 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 in the very beginning.
Is he the one who introduced that word, the death design type thing?
Yeah. He's also in one of my favorite independent films that I don't think many people have seen, but it's a movie called Sushi Girl. Mm-hmm. Sushi Girl, which stars, oddly enough, do you remember the kid from Independence Day, the oldest son of Russell Case, i.e. what's his name? Whatever his name is, the actor, the guy who's like...
Randy Quaid?
Randy Quaid, there you go. Yeah. I knew he was a Quaid, I just couldn't figure out the first name. The guy who plays his oldest son, he's in this movie, as well as a incredible Mark Hamill.
Oh.
And oddly...
I think he's shown me the trailer for this.
I think I have shown you the trailer, because one of the other guys in the movie is the kid from... Mind you, he's not a kid anymore... But he was the kid from Neverending Story. All grown up. And now, like, yeah. So, it's a very interesting movie, very niche. It's Mark Hamill at his most Joker-ish, like, personas. So, but I digress. We are talking about 1992's Candyman. This movie has been pretty much a staple when it comes to most classic 90s / late 80s horror movies. When you talk about the movies that really began to make horror iconic, and not just in a sense of like, oh my gosh, he killed like 200 people in the scene. Like, no, I mean like you make villains iconic. And that's kind of where Clive Barker works in. If you're not too familiar with movies that he's done prior to this, like he did Hellraiser, which Hellraiser is the movie that gave birth to Pinhead. So if you've ever seen a very pale, you know, skinned bald man with nails sticking out of every part of his head.
I remember seeing that in Blockbuster.
That is Pinhead. So Clive Barker really wanted to make a name and make a statement when it came to creating this villain, which, like I said, he didn't create the film. He created the short story. When it came to this particular movie, one of the unique standpoints that I really wanted to highlight and I really want to get into is, you know, the story behind, like, the subtext behind the actual story in the film, you know, because there's so much going on in the movie that if you blink and miss it, it's literally just a, you know, black bad guy goes after white good girl and tries to kill her movie.
Is she good, though?
I'm just saying, you know, there's a reason why she's so. Let's talk about impressions.
Okay,
I want to go ahead and see, Spence. What were some of your first impressions coming into this movie, without any, obviously seeing it without any notion of what you saw prior to?
Really, I didn't have any impressions. Just like I knew it was a popular movie, and you know. Lots of people liked it, so I was like, okay, like, let's see what's going on here.
Did you know anybody who had seen the movie prior?
You.
Well, aside from me, like, did you know, like, has your dad ever seen it? Has your mom have no any idea. Friends talk about
My
it?
My mom would never have watched this movie. This is not up her alley. I know that much. But, yeah, it's kind of one of those things where, like, you know, background, like, I knew people were aware of this movie.
Yeah, yeah. Thing. Okay, like, and for me, like, it's no-brainer. Obviously, I saw this when I was really young. Like, I'm pretty sure I probably saw it when it came out. I think it was 6. I saw it when it made its way to Blockbuster. Mm. All all the subsequent follow-ups, like the sequels, like Sins of the Flesh and all the kind of stuff, I saw those as well from Blockbuster. But this was one of those movies where, number one... growing up, like, so okay, let me talk about impressions first. Some of the biggest impressions or expectations, sorry, not impressions, expectations. Some of the biggest expectations that I had when it came to this particular movie was, please don't let this be like a letdown as to where my mind is thinking it's going to go. Like, you know, when you tell all your peoples, they're like, hey, you got to see this YouTube video. It's funny as heck. Oh, man. And you like send them the video and then you're like, you don't hear from them for like 30 minutes. And you're like, oh my God, they didn't think it was funny. Like, that was kind of my mindset with this movie. It's like, I remember seeing it when I was a kid, and I remember being scared. And not only that, but like the lore behind it. I remember like my family, my cousins doing this kind of stuff with me at home. Like, they would be quote unquote babysitting, but they would like throw me into a bathroom or put me in front of like a mirror. Like, no, like, so Spencer, you're looking at me weird.
Yes.
Like, this is what like family did. They, especially family who knew horror movie things like that and stuff like that. Like, they would force us to do like Candyman, or they would dare us to do it in the bathroom, or like, you know, what's her name? Bloody Mary, doing Bloody Mary in the bathroom. Like, we would get dared by our cousins, like, oh, I'll give you a quarter if you go do Bloody Mary in the bathroom, or you do this and that. Like, I remember the instances of like the lore as a child, you know, being told like, hey, you know, if you do this, then this is gonna happen. And it's not like so much a part of like historical lore, like, oh my gosh, this has roots back to the 1300s and blah. Like, I don't know, to be quite honest, but I know the roots it has in my childhood, because like, I remember even in school, we would do that at school. Like, kids would dare you to do that kind of stuff. Did you not ever experience this?
Nope. Like, the more we hang out, the more I realize we had very different childhoods.
I feel like you went to a white school, like a predominantly white school.
It was.
Really? Like, oh my God. Like, my school was like melting pot, like mixed race, bag of Skittles, like all colors of the rainbow. Mm-hmm. Everybody was there. You know, you had Latinos, you had, you know, black folk, you had Asians. And everybody's bringing their own scare to the table. It's like, oi, you know, and you hear stories that people have passed on to their kids who are trying to use their best judgment and memory to retell it to a bunch of other kids. You know, I've heard everything from like Russian kids talking about the boogeyman, like Baba Yaga. I remember hearing stories of kids who would have to like move their feet from the underneath the bed because they would fear that Baba Yaga would take them under and then take them into their walking house. Like, I didn't know stuff like that in school until I had friends who were Russian, or like Asian folk who would talk about the white ghosts that would show up and then like scream into your face and then take your soul. Like, these are the things. I had somebody once tell me, and I believed it like the idiot that I was, that there was such a thing as the Chiquita lady. And it didn't dawn on me until like months later. That's the name of the freaking banana woman. I was like, I can't believe I scared myself half to death going to bed thinking the Chiquita lady was going to get me.
Well, I mean, technically, the Chiquita lady is real. It's just, you know, she's a mascot.
Yeah. Well, yeah. I mean, bananas. Didn't know she was going to come and kill me in the middle of the night if I didn't eat bananas or something. I forgot what the lore was that they told me, or the story, but it was like inundated in my whole like presence to be like, to be cognizant of like, okay, there's an entity called the Chiquita lady and she's gonna come and find me. Like, my child. So I like talking about these things because exploring like the things that made me tick growing up really kind of make myself more aware of the things that I'm like, yeah, I could see that as an issue. Yeah, just
all right. So from my childhood, like, the only one that I know of was Bloody Mary, but the problem with me was I didn't really understand what they were talking about because I was aware of the adult drink Bloody Mary. So I think as a child...
Wait, hold on. Pause. Time out. Roll back the tape. So as a child, you were more aware of the alcohol than you were of the actual child's, like,
yeah, I think I was watching
lore.
Some show that had it in there. Because, like, I thought, like, you know, you do that and, like, some person brings you.
So if you make a Bloody Mary, then she comes after you. Bartender, make me another Bloody Mary. No! I could see it. Little Spencer, like, yeah, don't do it.
And I was like, I'm safe. I don't drink these, so whatever.
I'm covered in the blood of Christ. Oh, man. See, and the thing is, Latin folklore, I earnestly believe, was just created to scare the pants off of little kids. Like, there's no rhyme or reason for most of the stuff. Like, there's a tale of La Llorona, the woman who cries at the river because her children are dead and she's wanting to find her children. And if you hear her crying in the middle of the night, you need to cover yourself up and go to bed or she's going to find you and take you with her. And
well, it's like, that just sounds like an easy way to keep kids in bed.
Oh, and it worked. It worked. Like, you have no idea. So
these just sound like smart parenting stories.
Oh, Latins are not dumb. They know how to put their kid, like vieja, go put the kid to bed. And she's like, what do you want me to do? Scare him. Like, I feel like that's the way it all started. Like, somebody had a beer, and then they're like, mírale, do something where when she flaps her wings, it sounds like bones. That's actually part of the lore from Bloody, La Llorona. When she flies and she flaps her wings, it sounds like bones.
I'm not gonna ask questions about, because like why could this woman fly? She just lost her children.
Oh yeah, yeah, she's supernatural. Oh yeah, yeah. That's how, once you're dead, you can do anything. You know, that's how it rolls. But going back to Candyman, this was one of those instances where, like, knowing that there's lore behind it and people would bring it up and people would try to do it at school, it perpetuated the idea of this character throughout my entire life. Like, I'm thinking about it now and I still don't think I have the courage to go to a bathroom and say the name 5 times. And it's not because, well, maybe, might be partially because I'm scared, but it's not fully because I'm scared. It's just because it's like ingrained in my being that as a kid, those are the don'ts that you definitely don't do. Mm-hmm. Like, our peoples are superstitious up the wazoo. Like, you don't walk under, you know, under ladders. You don't, like, you have the main ones and then you have the Latin ones. Okay. Like, you're not allowed to point at a rainbow because if you point at a rainbow, a wart will appear at the tip of your finger. Oh yeah. Or if you ever look at somebody's fingernails and you see the little white dots, that's how many lies you've told. I am not making this stuff up. This is stuff that I was told
as
a kid. Very
specific.
Oh yeah. They get down. They know how to really, like, in order for you to survive a Latin household, you become not only hyper paranoid of everything that you are and you do, but you're also hyper aware of all the things that other people say and do. But when my parents were, you know, younger, apparently my mom likes to tell the story how when my dad saw a rainbow and he looked over and he held his fist out and he had his knuckle kind of partially out, like if he had a gun in his hand, like he was holding the trigger but the finger wasn't fully extended, and he's like, "Hey, look, there's a rainbow." And my mom's like, "What are you doing?" And he goes, no, I'm the rainbow that's over there. And she goes, "Why is your finger like?" He goes, "Because you're not allowed to point." And my mom tells that story all the time. But it's like, that's how, and my dad at the time was like in his mid-30s. Oh my God. He was like in his mid-30s. I don't know. Who knows? But that kind of paranoia slash like superstitious way is like ingrained in all of us. So you look at something like Candyman, of course it's going to be something that you can't really forget. Now, the movie, however, let's talk about impressions, because I know when it comes to like what I think and what you think can sometimes be on the same page, and then sometimes they're on two different continents. So I am anxious because we have yet to really talk about it. You and I have yet to really unload how each of us felt about the movie. I mean, I've talked a little to the extent before we went on the air, but I want to know, what is your first impression of this film? What are some of your first impressions?
Okay, so today, I'm going to also give you a second impression because I kind of changed. Like, because coming off this movie, I was like, I hate this movie. I don't like it. And it's not really, because it falls into the same thing that The Invisible Man did, where there is someone telling people one thing, uh-huh. and then everyone's like, oh, you're crazy, blah, blah, blah. I hate that. Like, I hate that in movies.
Yeah,
it
yeah.
bothers me a lot. But as I thought about it, I realized that I really don't like Helen, like, as a character, because I feel like she is the worst. Like,
she's the worst. Okay.
Because just later on, when people start questioning her about stuff, instead of being like, you know, oh, let me, like, you know, give you logical responses back, she just starts, like, leaning into the crazy, which seems like the worst thing to do when you're not actually crazy. baffling. She's baffling. Baffling.
Yeah?
What about you? I know this isn't your first time watching it, but...
No. You know, a lot of my takes on the film are kind of steeped in different things. I just happen to run the gambit on, like, understanding the place that, you know, African Americans have within the cinematic history of the world. And one of the greatest things that I've been able to do is be able to see this incredible documentary on Shudder and kind of have a little bit of an inkling as to, like, where a lot of the inspiration for a lot of these character roles for black people in cinema have come from. And so for me, watching Candyman, it was more of like a cathartic journey into seeing a character that kind of stretched outside the mold of what you would have as a typical villain. And even more so, have him be so prominent on screen. I mean, let's just talk about, like, Tony Todd is incredible. Yeah. Like, his on-screen presence is always commanding. Like, I kid you not. Every time he shows up in any movie or any scene, he steals it.
Mm-hmm. Even before he, like, showed his face in this one, he's just like, Helen. I'm like, just, like, snap paying attention to this movie now.
Yeah, like, his little narrative, like, be my victim. It's like, okay.
Yeah, that was upsetting.
I was like, yeah. Like, Tony Todd is insane.
Yeah.
And just not only his on-screen presence, but his voice, like, mm-hmm. just his deep, resonating voice is so prevalent throughout this film that you're actually at some point kind of rooting to want to see him. Like, you hear his voice for the first half of the film, and then once the second half comes in, that's when you first see him. And that's when all the crazy starts happening. Mm-hmm. But you're like, you're listening to him. You're like, oh my gosh, this voice. It's like, this could be God for all I know. And I would totally listen. But Tony Todd is just phenomenal in the role as well as just as an actor altogether. And having the opportunity to see somebody like Tony Todd really just stretch out that role of, you know, prior to this, I mean, what were the typical roles of most black folk? You had comic relief. You had thug, gangster, slave, servant. You know, there were always the second fiddle character to whatever was happening with the main. Or if they were even close to being main, there was a sense of like, oh, well, he's only in this position because, you know, he's with this person or he's doing that. Like, no offense, I love Richard Pryor to death, but at the same time, like a lot of his movies with Gene Wilder, I don't know if they would have had the same comedic effect without the other.
Right.
You know, and that's not to say Richard Pryor's not capable. He's completely capable. I'm just saying, didn't need Gene Wilder, you know, in certain aspects. And yeah, we had certain instances, certain like really niche opportunities where, you know, the black character was a standout performer. For instance, like during the 70s, you had Blackula, which, yeah, sounds like a very like hokey film, but the fact that he's like this cool, suave, Dracula-esque type character in a world that is, you know, predominantly white, you know, it's just, it's astounding. Not to mention one of the most prolific horror films of our generation, of our lifetime, George A. Romero's Night of the Living Dead, has a prominent black man as the lead, you know, and but the thing is, like I said, that's here and there. That's, you know, very few and far between. And so kind of fast forward back to 1992, and you have somebody like Tony Todd, who is standing front and center in this film, who is, he is a soft-spoken, horrific character who is literally, like, hypnotizing this white woman to do whatever he needs. Like, we to be quite frank, we don't know if she didn't do any of this stuff in the movie. We just know she's the one who ends up being there at the end. Mm-hmm. You know, like the idiot that she is, who yep. stays at the crime scene. But okay.
Honestly, who does stay at the crime scene? So, it's like you see blood and screaming. I'm like, eh,
no, yeah. No, I would have been like, and then ran. But he is on screen for maybe at the most like 10 minutes out of an hour and a half movie, and yet he is still the most recognizable thing about that movie.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you have other performers in the film. You have Virginia Madsen, who plays Helen Lyle. Xander Berkeley, by the way, always plays a jerk. Xander Berkeley plays Trevor Lyle.
Seems like he's going to be really good at being a jerk because despicable in this movie.
Well, did you ever see that movie Air Force One?
Nope.
You never saw Air Force One mm-hmm. with Harrison Ford? Well, Xander Berkeley.
Wait, is that the one where he's the president?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, yeah, sorry.
The traitor, the traitor Secret Service agent?
Mm-hmm.
Same actor.
Oh.
So, jerk.
Get off my plane.
Not to mention, you get really cool cameo by Sam Raimi's brother, Ted Raimi. He's the guy at the very beginning who's in that like story scenario that the girl is telling. You know, oh, you know, Billy goes over what's her name's house, and he's sitting there, and they're like, you know, oh, you know, he's waiting downstairs, and blah blah. The guy that's like came on the motorcycle,
right?
That's Sam Raimi's brother.
Okay,
so really fun little thing there, but the two main individuals that we really get a sense for, not to mention Cassie Lemons, Bernadette Walsh, her character, she's wonderful in this movie. But the main two people we have is Virginia Madsen and Tony Todd. Virginia Madsen, who is this researcher doing a thesis. One of the most unique things about this movie is I don't know if it was her, like, straight inability to do the smart thing, or if that's the way it was written, but like Helen Lyle, for her being a quote unquote graduate student, was not very bright.
No.
But what did you think about Helen Lyle, Virginia Madsen's character?
Okay, so like for like the beginning part of the movie, like she's fine. Like she's doing like research into like the Candyman story, and I'm fine. It's just, it's really once, you know, the Candyman comes into play.
Yeah.
That's when I start to have massive problems with her, because she is somehow like helping the Candyman to make her look bad.
Yeah.
Which is just the oddest decision to make to me. And it's very confusing, really, because, like, you know, instead of, like, you know, for instance, when for some reason the police release her,
mm-hmm.
which is also an insane decision, but whatever.
Yeah.
They release her after she's been accused of doing something to a baby, which they don't know yet because they can't find the body. She finds, like, slide photos of, like, you know, the Candyman in the background and mentions it to nobody.
Right, there's little evidence of this right in front of her face, and it's like, do you not call somebody? Do you not say, like, hey, I have the killer's picture. come over here so I can give this to you, so that way you can go catch the right guy.
Yeah. And even if she's imagining it, like, that's at least verification for her that something is going on, you know?
No, without a doubt. And it's one of those situations where I don't know if it was written that way or if that's the way Virginia Madsen made it, but, like,
I feel like it had to be written that way. Well, unless she's making the call flies.
Take a look at like the Twilight movies. Mm-hmm. And what's her name?
Bella Swan.
Kristen Stewart.
Okay.
The actual actress. The actress is worse than the role she played. But look at everything she did in that movie, and that was a horrible set of movies. You're lucky.
I saw part of the movie where, like, she was giving birth while I was waiting for a Comcast to do a thing in their office. It was horrifying.
Your one reference to this character is when she's giving birth to a vampire baby.
Yes.
Okay, just wanted to make sure on that.
Don't recommend it. Don't recommend starting there.
It's like, it's just, she's so wooden in the role. And it's like, he's asking her, like, do you know who I am? Yes. Say it. You're a vampire. It's like, you're not Batman. Like, use some...
He is now.
Not him, her.
Oh, yeah.
No, she's not Batman.
She's not Batman, though.
He is. So I don't know if it's like a combination of both the acting... and the direction, I don't know. But I was getting really strong vibes. Like, I don't know if you got this out of the movie, but I was getting heavy, heavy vibes of, like, white saviorism in this movie.
Yeah.
Because the issue that I had was, like, okay, you had Virginia Madsen come into this project with the aid of her, you know, black friend, mm-hmm. who is kind of light-skinned black, number one, to gain access into there. And then all the things that were going on, like, she made it her issue. Like, oh, the murders that happened here, I need to find out. Or whatever's going on, we need to find this man. Like, not to say that, like, they didn't need somebody to come in and do that, but to say, like, give it to the proper people, you know? The black folk don't need white people to come in and say, this is how you get it done. And I felt like that was kind of her stance when she came in there. And even not so, like, so on the nose, but, like, subtle little hints of that. It's like, why? First off, this isn't safe to be here. You don't belong in this neighborhood. No,
it
is not.
And it was really crazy that, like, they were there at all.
Yeah. No. 100%. It's like, why are you even here? You are an unarmed white woman with another unarmed light-skinned black woman.
Also, like, when they were entering these projects, she was like, it's okay, they think we're cops. I'm like, no, that's bad, actually.
You don't want them to think you're cops.
No.
Do you know what they do to cops around here? It didn't make sense from a story standpoint until you like get the whole mindset of, like, the way this story is essentially supposed to be told is essentially like a story of how white people view the black experience, the African-American experience here in the U.S. I mean, take a look at, like, the projects. A clear indicator when, you know, Helen throws open her blinds and you're like, oh, yeah, there it is. Like, she can see the projects from her home. And it's like, so you're literally a stone's throw away, but you get to live in luxury with panels on your walls while everyone else has to have cinder block, painted cinder block in their home. You know, it kind of got me thinking of, like, you know, okay, I get it, but do a lot of other people get it, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And that just goes towards, like, the idea of what Clive Barker was doing. Because, like I said, if you look at Candyman, Tony Todd is not an intimidating, scary person in the movie.
No.
Now, mind you, when you find the story of his origins in the movie, when they talk about it, how he was an acclaimed artist, a black acclaimed artist during the times, you know, when slaves were free, and fell in love with this, you know, farmer's daughter, or this wealthy white man's daughter. They didn't like it. They cut off his drawing hand. And then slathered them with honey, or they put them in something, and then into where the beehives were.
Mm-hmm.
And he essentially got stung to death. That is probably something that has more than likely happened during that time. Like, I don't know if there's any truth in terms of, like, the experience that have happened to people then. I have no doubt it probably has, or if not, something worse. But then you have that character coming back to help people understand. And I don't... Here's the thing. I don't think Candyman was wanting to create a sense of dread within the community, because the community is already scared. Like, there's no doubt in my mind that everybody in that project's area was already aware and scared of who Candyman was.
Right.
I feel like it was more of a remember where you came from, remember that this is what they do, this is how they are, that if you seem out of place, they will try to put you back where you belong, and if not, take you out of this world so that you don't have a place, period.
See, I guess that's part of one of the things I wasn't quite sure about in this movie was, like, you know, the Candyman didn't want to be forgotten by the community, and I get that part, but I wasn't fully sure as to the whys, because it mostly seemed like he just wanted to, like, live forever type thing, and it was less concerned about, like, with the community in itself.
Yeah, but live forever in what way? Like, that's
in the way that he currently is.
But nobody's seen him.
Yeah, but, like, he's still, like, around.
Yeah.
Yeah, in a weird non-life type way.
Yeah. But, like, I'm saying, though, like, with this movie... And mind you, this is just an interpretation. Like, I really feel like there's probably smarter people out there who can probably give it a little bit more depth or credence. But I really feel like the idea that what Candyman was trying to do was not to remind people of the fear in him, but remind them of the fear of those that try to oppress. That's what lives on forever in my mind. Like, Candyman wants people to recognize that that he is the example of that dominance, if you will.
See, I would agree with that if he wasn't also attacking the same people, because he's attacking people in that community too. And that seems like that's a really mixed message.
Because justice is blind, dude. There's no.
Oh my gosh, yeah.
Like, there's no rhyme or reason for things that happen. One person is, you know, the abduction of a child or a baby, and the beheading of a dog. And then in another instance, it's an affluent black woman who's in a white woman's house. You know, and then, like, there's, in my mind, that kind of really just solidifies the blind justice that Candyman hopes that there is there, but unfortunately doesn't exist.
Well, I feel like most of the reasons why he did those specific things were because he was trying to get Helen in his very odd roundabout way.
Be my victim.
Yeah, he really wanted a victim for some reason. Mm-hmm. Well, because she looked like the previous. Like, she just looked like her, right? Not like she's some weird reincarnation, right? That's what they were trying to go with.
She looked like her. Yeah, but that's maybe what... that's what he was, you know, liking. Who knows? Talking about the movie a little bit more, like, what were some of the things that you kind of felt were issues for you in the movie? Because I know you have a few outside of the ones we've just already mentioned.
Many of my issues just revolve around Helen. But other than her, no, they're all her, really, when I think about it. Because, like, for instance, when she is taking into, like, that psychiatrist's office.
Uh-huh.
And she's like, let me show you. And she summons Candyman.
Mm-hmm.
I don't understand what she thought she was actually going to happen.
That, like, he was just going to...
Yeah, like... The hey, how's hubris. It going?
Nice to meet you, Doctor. Yeah, I'm Candyman. I'm the guy killing people here. And yeah. You don't mind if I put a hook in your chest, do you? I'm just gonna wedge this bad boy in there. Don't worry, insurance will cover that.
It's just like maybe I don't understand what they're really going for, but it's so crazy to me that she thinks she can just call, like, this guy, like, a dog, and he's just gonna show up and, like, validate everything that's happened. Like, it seems.
But did he though?
Well, he showed up, but he killed the guy. So.
But it didn't really validate.
No, I'm trying to say, like, that's what she thinks is going to happen.
Oh, in her mind. Gotcha. Yes. I could see that. I just, mind you, this movie doesn't necessarily derive all of the unique goodness from the short story, unfortunately. But I do feel like the movie still does have some sense of roots within what the underlying story is. Mm-hmm. You know, you have essentially a story of, like, you know, white saviorism. You have a sense of, like, gentrification. You know, like I said, why does the building that Helen lives in, why is that much more well taken care of and well to do, and yet the one a few blocks away, which is designed exactly like, which they make every effort to say is designed exactly like her property, like her apartments, but they look like garbage.
Yeah,
you know, and there's like spray paint on the wall, and there's like there's chain link fences that look out, and it's the idea of that there is a world out there, there is a sense of people out there who will always have the haves, and there are people like you and I who will always be considered the have-nots, you know. And going back to what I was saying earlier, one of the running threads of this movie is the amount of people who have this belief in this thing. There's a sense of fear, but it's like they're all tied together because of this, you know, this one thing, and that's their belief in Candyman. And sometimes in like areas where people grew up like that, or sometimes in places, sometimes all you have to share is stories. Sometimes all you have is to give your experience with this, you know, like I was mentioning about earlier about the Chiquita lady.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's that I don't believe that's something real, but that was something that I later on laughed at, and then I shared it with other people, and I made it kind of a lore, like, oh yeah, you got to be careful with the Chiquita lady, she drops out of the trees and she blah blah blah, like yeah, like things like that. And I've told other people that, I've told kids that, and I've, you know, and they've taken that scary story, that lore, and they've made it theirs, and now they share that. And mind you, yeah, they're just silly stories, sometimes they're just ridiculous, sometimes they're based in fear. You know, you have the story of Candyman, which is kind of a combination between, like I said, Bloody Mary and the story of the hook, which is the story of, like, oh, this guy and this girl were hanging out on the side of the road, and she hears a noise, and the guy gets out to check, and he doesn't see anything, and then she hears a really crazy scraping noise. They both freak out. He turns on the car and drives really, really fast. When they finally get to where they're going, they both get out of the car, look at the side of the car, and there's a hook that's attached to the car with, you know, a part of the limb that it was attached to. But, like, you get those stories that have been in, you know, the echelons of, like, campfires and you know, recess, you know, circle groups or whatever. You have all these stories, and sometimes those stories are what keeps people connected, you know. And it's a weird thing to look at it and say we're connected by fear, but to be quite frank, it's no different than what we as adults deal with today. You know, looking at the world around us, we are literally all connected by the fear of, like for the last 4 years, we were connected by the fear of a Cheeto puff in the White House. You know, oh, what's it gonna do today? Like, you know. And sometimes fear is a bad thing, but it can also be a good thing in terms of creating a sense of preparedness, or even a sense of, like, readiness for whatever happens in the world. It's all in the package, you know, plain and simple. It's all in the package. But I really feel like Candyman, this movie, hits on a lot of different elements that just really, they just have a really unique way of being presented in a movie, like, mm-hmm. like I was saying, with gentrification, with white saviorism, with recognizing some of the few truly honest things that connect us, you know. I don't know, what do you think?
I will say, like, you know, during like our exploration of like horror movies in general, this is more general than specifically for this movie. I'm really like intrigued that I found like such like, you know, like actual like real world, like, you know, context of like, you know, of classism and that kind of stuff in like these types of movies, because I, that was not something I was really expecting going in. Like, because like when Get Out did it, I was like, oh wow, this is super great. But I didn't like know, like, actually there's a history of like this kind of thing happening in these types of movies. And so like it's been real eye opening. Like, just like to look at it from like, you know, a movie history perspective.
Yeah. And I was talking to I was talking to our junior filmlosopher, Sarah, the other day, and I was telling her the honest fact about the world we're in today is that if you look at every medium there is, one of the most consistent and most accessible forms of history we have in the world today are movies. You look at film, and whether or not if it's a retelling of a great Greek story, or if it's a remembrance of a time on a beach during the early 1940s, or if it's a modern interpretation of a Shakespearean love story between two people on opposite sides of a war, whatever you see, whatever you look at, the opportunity is that this part of history can easily be accessed, you know, accessed by you and I with the click of a button, or by the drive of to a movie theater, maybe not anytime soon, but to drive to the movie theater, or like turning on the TV or jumping onto the computer. Movies have become the most accessible way to view the history of the world around us. And sometimes it's not so obvious, and sometimes it's a little bit more subtle, but the story is still there. You brought up a really great example with Jordan Peele's Get Out. The idea that somebody decided to make a movie based on the fact that there is countless people who view racism as a non-existent thing and don't see the dangers of that mindset. Yet there is countless people who are not black who try to appropriate black culture and make it their own to be successful. I was talking about this with Sarah, and I was telling her, you know, one of the biggest things that has kind of been shaken up has been the recognition of cultural appropriation of like black urban culture by everybody, from white people all the way to like Asian people, and capitalizing on that. One of the biggest offenders, and I hate to say this on the podcast, but I it's kind of true, Awkwafina, who is a unique Asian actress who's doing really great right now. She's in the new Shang-Chi movie for Marvel. But about 5-6 years ago was like super super urban, like hey yo, what's up, blah blah blah, and I'm like, you know, and mind you, there has to be a balance. There has to be a sensitive balance. You have to see, you know, okay, where is this person from? Are they raised this way, or is this just something they're appropriating to make their image further, you know, progress? In my opinion, the fact that we have not seen that persona of Awkwafina since, you know, Ocean's 8 kind of says a lot to me. Like, maybe somebody who was closer to her was like, hey, you know, you're not black, don't do that. Like, I don't know, maybe, who knows. But the idea that cultural appropriation is such a real thing that even to this extent where people want to step into your body to be black, to have the freedom to say the N-word, like to be able to do these things, to run, like I don't. Jordan Peele hit a nerve so strong that people are still studying that film even today in ways that can further, you know, just expound upon the idea of the subtle racism here in the United States. And mind you, nowadays, it's not so subtle.
No.
But back then when that movie first came out, it was very subtle. It's like, oh, I'm not racist. I have a black friend. That's racist.
Yep.
Or, you know, oh, you know, I bet you're super strong, because, you know, I bet you could run really fast. You must really like basketball, right? Because you're black. It's like, dude, that's subtle racism. Now people are just like, hey, N-word is like, nope, that's nope, you gotta go. You gotta go. Like, we can't even walk into a Starbucks anymore without people throwing that around. So the further we progress in making opportunities for movies to have these stories be told and have the opportunity for people like us to kind of unfold carefully what this is and really just dive deep into a tale of somebody who was wronged so much so that his spirit has yet to rest. And even if that's the fullest brunt of the story, if that's it, even that has a lesson in itself. Like, the actual true dread of humanity is each other. Mm. We are capable of horrible things. And in a time where there wasn't as much accountability, people did some horrible stuff, you know? So, yeah, I agree. Virginia Madsen, Helen Lyle's character, wasn't exactly the smartest, you know, blonde on screen that we've seen in a long time. But I have to give credit where credit is due. And Tony Todd really does accentuate mm-hmm. the idea of that just romantic love loss. It's on a sense of like something Edgar Allan Poe would write, or, you know, a very dark gothic writer would take a tale. Even Tim Burton would take a story like that and just transform it into something that has a sense of beauty, but also a sense of loss to it, you know? Any last thoughts before we get into our discussion question?
I want to mention my favorite character in this movie, besides Tony Todd.
I'm going to take a wild guess, but I'm going to wait because I think I know who it is.
No, I want to know who's your guess? Who's your guess?
I would say Anthony.
Oh, no. Which one's Anthony?
Oh, no, not Anthony. Because Anthony was the baby.
Oh, yeah.
You're going to say the little kid?
Yeah. Jake.
Best actor
in the movie. Because when Helen is talking to this kid, he's like, I don't know about that.
you're going to get us killed. What's wrong with you?
Yeah, he is my favorite and was a breath of fresh air.
He was good.
Showed up. I loved him.
He was great. Just that whole scene where they're sitting in the police station and she's sitting next to him and she's like, you said you weren't going to tell anyone. And she's like, Jake, Candyman isn't real. He's not real. Oh, Candyman's not real? It just sips whatever's in that cup. I would have believed it was coffee, bourbon, anything else. That kid had like some moxie to him. He's like, Candyman ain't real. It just that was
this kid gets stuff done. He's also the reason that Helen burned alive later in the movie.
Oh yeah,
because he's like, she's crawling in through the guard file and has that hook. Why does she have the hook? I don't understand. What, and he sees the hook going in. He's like, it's time.
Right?
Just gathers everyone.
I know. What time of night is this? Apparently, there was
I was thinking like after midnight or something.
It looked like it was after midnight. Yeah. And like all these people gathering together just to burn a pile. I'm like, this looks like fun. Like, I'd go there. So, wrapping this thing up.
Yeah. You didn't have any highlights?
Oh, I did. Yeah, all that stuff I said about Tony Todd and the efforts of the movie. So, before we wrap this up, I do have a question. And this is a discussion question for today. So, after seeing this movie, Spencer, mm-hmm. and myself, after seeing this movie, what are you hoping to see changed or made the same in the upcoming remake?
Okay. So this probably will surprise nobody, but delete Helen. Like, just take her out of the movie.
Really?
Like, unless, like, I know Jordan Peele's, like, involved in the new one. Unless he thinks he can salvage her, I'd be like, we don't need this kind of, like, nonsense. Like, the, you know, people are accusing you of crazy, and you're going to then proceed to act crazier than they think you are.
True.
Like, you don't need that for yourself in your life. So I'd like to not retrudge that up. What about you, Eddie?
You know, there's a bunch of things that I'd wanna see continued. I wanna see the romanticism of Tony Todd's character as the Candyman. Maybe not so much by Tony Todd, but I just wanna see him. I wanna see that character continue to have the opportunities to showcase that he's not a cold-blooded. I mean, he is a killer, but there's a sense of romanticism behind his character development, and I want to see that come to fruition. And I think they touched on it in the first film. I want to see it kind of fully developed. Also, I want to see how they're going to incorporate that twisted version of Say My Name into this movie. Because, like, you remember when that trailer dropped?
Yeah, that was pretty good.
Like, it was like, Say my name. I'm like, oh shoot, about to go back to the 90s.
They're really good at incorporating those old songs into these trailers.
Between that and Five on It, I'm gonna have a whole soundtrack ready to go. I want to see how they're gonna incorporate that, but overall, I want to see how Naya DaCosta is going to handle Clive Barker's story and give it that through the lens of whatever Jordan Peele is on that movie, because he's not the director, but he is one of the writers. So he's writing the screenplay. I want to see that incredible, like, Jordan Peele touch in this story, and I want to see how it's going to round everything out. And maybe not so much in the realm of, like, focusing on Virginia Madsen's character getting vengeance at the end of the film, like in that one. Mm-hmm. But I want to see what Jordan is going to say. You know, I think it is just the way it's to best put it. I want to see how he's going to say it, and I want to see how it's going to come to fruition. I was looking at the actual cast list. Mm-hmm. I noticed something. Hmm. The main character, the main guy, mm-hmm. his name is Anthony McCoy.
Oh.
Anne-Marie McCoy, the actual actress.
Uh-huh.
Is in this as well.
Oh, very interesting.
So, I'm excited. But
that's interesting, because I was actually thinking about that earlier, like before. I was like, you know, they could probably bring back some of, like, you know, the actors from this one who survived as, like, older ones. But
No. Looking at this, like, the first thing I noticed is Vanessa Williams, from the woman who played Anne-Marie McCoy. She's the mom in this one as Anne-Marie McCoy, as well as Anthony McCoy is the main character. So I am even more stoked. I'm excited. This is going to be good. Not to mention, Tony Todd plays the character again. So the name that was in the movie that wasn't really touched on was his name, Daniel Robitaille, something like that. But he plays that character in this movie. So I don't know if he's just gonna be used for, like, flashbacks or whatever. I don't know. I'm excited. I'm anxious, and I'm ready to see this movie already. So wrapping this whole thing up, let's go ahead and go across the table. We'll start with you, Spence. Does the film pass or fail, and how many monocles?
Yeah, you know, this movie passes for me. It was really fun to watch, and, like, I was surprised with how, like, deep it was, like, when it touched on, like, you know, racial aspects and that kind of stuff. Even though I was not the biggest fan of Helen, she does not drag down the movie that much for me.
Thankfully.
For me to, you know, really hate on it. Just like the initial first impression, like, after it was over, I was like, I hate her and I hate this movie. But, like, now that I'm calmed down.
Take her in her bald cap and go to Freddy.
Yeah, so, like, I'm going to give this a 4 out of 5. It was good to watch.
This film passes for me. This has a lot more hold in my, you know, in my childhood, in terms of, like, the lore, and, like I said, doing all those things. Like, the idea of who Candyman is and was permeates every part of my childhood. along with every other story that I have, every other lore that I believed, every other, you know, like I said, campfire tale, recess, you know, circle story, you know, hanging at the monkey bars or sitting on the seesaws, like all those things. These were the stories I told. These were the stories that we all told. And I love having this movie as part of my heritage and part of my history. And I'm anxious to see, like I said, what Naya DaCosta is going to be doing. So this film passes for me, and I'm going to give it a 4 out of 5 as well. I love the movie. I loved everything that it does. I know that Clive Barker wanted more out of it, but it was good nevertheless. 4 out of 5, solid movie. So, with all that said, that about wraps up another awesome episode of the Filmlosophers. Remember, you can check us out at filmlosophers.com. There you can check out all of our previous episodes. We have everything from anime to horror to everything. In fact, you can even check out the month we did 2 years ago in October, where Spencer did his deep dive into horror movies.
Yeah, that was interesting.
Or was it last year? No, it was the year before. Yes, the year before. Check that out, because it was a great series of episodes, and let us know your thoughts. You can also check us out on the socials at facebook.com/filmlosophers and on Twitter and Instagram at filmlosophy101. We'd love to hear your thoughts. Check us out as we go to press screenings and we post there, letting you know we are out and about in the chaos. Also, you can listen to us wherever podcasts can be heard. So check us out over on Google Play, Libsyn, Player FM, Audio Boom, iTunes, Pandora, Spotify. Check us out there, Filmlosophers. We'd love to get your listen, and we'd love to get a 5-star review from you if you think we deserve it. We deserve it. I think we deserve it.
I think we do, too.
We do. This has been a great and interesting story and a great, interesting conversation, and it definitely makes you wonder how they're going to transpire into what the new movie's going to have, and what they're going to take from this one and what they're going to remove and make better. Or, possibility, make worse. I mean, who knows?
That is always an option.
That is always a sad and unfortunate option. So, but yeah, we look forward to next week, and we hope you do as well. So, from all of us here at the Filmlosophers, I'm Eddie.
I'm Spence.
Class dismissed.